Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 22nd, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host. Today we are doing a continuation of a two-part series. The first part was on last week and it's archived on the LaRouche Pub website. If you want to go back and listen to it, you can. Today we're doing part two on the new LaRouche Pack pamphlet, Is the Devil in Your Laptop? And as listeners heard who listened to it last week, we started with a discussion of the warnings from Lyndon LaRouche's, as usual, prophetic introduction to the pamphlet, From Milken and Enron to Perugia, Extreme Events, where he discussed how the so-called Internet Revolution, with the interactive social websites such as MySpace and Facebook, combined with the violent video games on the computer, are creating the conditions from which are already emerging terrorists, killers, as we've seen in the last few weeks, hit a mall in Omaha, Nebraska, and another one hitting two churches in Colorado. There were the events in Finland and, of course, the hideous slaughter at Blacksburg, Virginia, at Virginia Tech. But what LaRouche warned in that is that there's a whole new generation of terrorists, homegrown terrorists, being created, of young people who are constantly on video games, on the Internet, and in a constantly excited state of virtual reality. Last week we had several members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who were with me on a panel to discuss this. Today we're going to have three more authors from that pamphlet, The Devil in Your Laptop, or Is the Devil in Your Laptop, and we'll be giving out the number that you can call to order copies of this, because we're going to get 500,000 of these out before the end of 2007. But joining us for this program this afternoon will be Gabriela Arroyo-Reyes, who wrote the article, The Cyborgs of Silicon Valley. Also, we will have Ouyang Teng, who wrote Video Games and the Wars of the Future, and then Dave Christie, Handmaidens of British Colonialism, a fascinating article on the social networking of individuals who are profiling the generation out of which they're creating terrorists. So let me open with Gabby, who has written an extremely interesting article on the background, and I did some work on this myself and was somewhat interested in the cover story that was created about how it was hippies and people who were interested in democratizing the web who created the Internet Revolution for the purposes of taking it out of the hands of the defense agencies. And what Gabby demonstrates here is that, in fact, most of those so-called hippies in the counterculture, the people who created the cyberculture, were doing it on behalf of the defense establishment. So, Gabby, why don't you give us a little background on where this so-called Internet Revolution came from?
Well, I think one thing to point out is that you had, this whole era right now, as it's being discussed, some people call it artificial intelligence, other people call it robotics, or, as is also famous in computer science, really emerged from a series of conferences that were being sponsored immediately after the death of Roosevelt, starting in 1946. And what they were looking at originally was hypnotism. It was called cerebral inhibition. And this is later on, this emerged into what was a series of meetings that were taking place with cyberneticians. People, Norbert Wiener, John von Neumann, Arturo Rosenbluth, and it was the first collaboration of a conglomerate of its type where you had sociologists, psychologists, and engineers coming together, where they were essentially discussing the basis of looking at the mind as a binary code, something that could be programmed. And over time, you had the defense, specifically DARPA, got involved in this, and started recruiting from major universities, which we consider today MIT, Harvard, Stanford, University of California.
Now, DARPA was run through the Defense Department, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is the Department of Defense.
Right. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So basically what they were looking at was a question of how to create essentially a mode of control that would be more powerful than the drugs. Because the idea was people could only get, you couldn't get the entire population to become addicted to psychotropic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you had something more powerful, more inducing of this kind of brainwashing that they wanted to promote in a way where it seemed more subtle and could program it, could massively distribute this into the culture, then you would have a form of social control that would be much more powerful than the drug counterculture.
Hmm.
And that's when you had the beginning of these video games that started out, where you had the first collaboration of the military with the industrial component.
Was this
Hollywood.
The Space War game as the initial operation?
No, it actually started a lot prior to that. It started with what was called just war games. These were basically like board games.
Mm-hmm.
People would sit down and you had certain rules. They were board games. And eventually, through the invention of the computer, it became a more elaborate form where they were mapping out certain reenactments of real wars that were taking place. And along those lines, they were incorporating all sorts of realistic graphic designs.
Hmm.
But yeah, this came specifically out of the Department of Defense.
Now, I'd like to ask David, because he's done some work on these networks of sociologists. Gabby, that was very interesting, this whole question of how do you go beyond something that had a certain limitation, that is the drug culture, because not everybody wanted to turn on. But people are turning on computers in every household. So David did some work on the sociological networks that were involved in this, the Margaret Mead, Bateson, and others. What can you add to what we had presented from Gabby so far?
I think that this idea of the game theory is crucial. And there was, you know, all kinds of groupings that were looking at, you know, various strategies around the Cold War. And in particular, some of these same networks that were looking around how do you game the Cold War, run scenarios for it, those same networks were also running the operations around the social engineering. Kind of what I guess I would say is that what really, in terms of looking further into this, what I'm seeing is that there's kind of a gang-counter-gang scenario being set up in academia. On the one hand, they would say that there was the sort of the might is right, kind of the outlook of Leo Strauss and some of the game theory crowd out of the Rand Institute, right? As being kind of the so-called right wing. But then on the flip side, what you have is this grouping around the Frankfurt School kind of outgrowth. But these were the people then that were running the social engineering operations, say, out of Tavistock, the networks around Kurt Lewin, Paul Lazarus.
So these were the touchy-feely killers.
Right. This is, in some ways, the way it kind of works out is that they'll take the approach that, you know, if we could only get rid of these superstructures like the state and go back to a more organic, tribal existence, if you will, that would eliminate what we see with the insanity around these aggressions of World War, which they saw as, you know, the so-called authoritarian personality. That's what they would term it. And so in the attempt to get rid of the authoritarian personality, hoping that would, or with the sort of the argument that that would eliminate these war drives, then you could go back to this, you know, what you say, the touchy-feely, everyone gets along because we're all sort of like animals, and or, you know, what they had in mind as some kind of ideal tribal existence where everyone was just happy with each other and, you know, the only enemies were the animals that you were fighting against or something, you know. So this leads into this sort of gang-counter-gang. In one sense, you could say it's sort of the Straussian neoconservative outlook versus then this left-leaning Frankfurt School, the people around Lewin, Lazarsfeld, right? The grouping that I in particular looked at, we had been getting harassment.
Well, David, let me come back to that because I want to bring that in, but I also want to bring in Ouyang here because it's the natural segue from what you just said is what Ouyang wrote about in the Revolution in Military Affairs, the operation run at the top by two old hardcore fascists, George Shultz and Felix Roetten. In your article, Ouyang, you talk about how this whole development that David and Gabby have been describing came together in this idea of the Revolution in Military Affairs. Why don't you describe that to us?
Yeah, well, I mean, in one sense, there's not a lot of mystery to it if people are willing to look at, you know, consider history and the way history actually is unfolded over at least the last 50 years. But, you know, you've had an attempt really going back to this to the period after the war, which is, as LaRouche has often pointed out, is a real turning point for the country. Because it's after the death of Roosevelt that you've got a marked shift in terms of the outlook and more and more the control of the institutions going over to the side of turning the United States into either a super empire or a junior partner with the British in this kind of imperial operation. So this hit with full force, and one of the obvious places to initiate this was in the military. Now, we could kind of take it on the inverse and look at what's happening today, and we should ask the question, how the hell did what we get today, how did that happen? How did we get, you know, a military...
You mean the violent video games?
Well, I'm talking about Iraq,
oh, okay.
Afghanistan,
sure.
The war on terror, you know, and say, how is it that we have become this? Relative to, you know, what you saw, say, in World War II, where you had an actual Republican military, you know, we had an actual mission. So I think that's useful, particularly for people, to force yourself to reflect on the fact that we're living right now in an insane situation. And part of the problem with, I think, even people who are younger than I am, who maybe grew up when the Iraq War was already, you know, self-evident, so to speak, they have to get some perspective that this is really this is a signal of the destruction of the country and the destruction of the military. But the key idea behind it is that the military is going to be the enforcer for really what turns out to be globalization. I mean, there's names for it: democracy, stabilization, etc. But the idea is that the military itself is going to be this the expression of a new kind of world that's emerged after the era of the nation states, which is now it's disintegrating with the shutting down of, you know, the elimination of the borders and the internet. And so in this new world, you're going to have a military that reflects this kind of world of anarchy.
It's interesting because you have the means and the ends are, in a sense, interchangeable then, because what I was thinking where you were going was this question of how it is that some of these video games, which are producing the new terrorists, were originally produced for the military so they could be more effective through this revolution of military affairs.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where you have a direct link-up between what's happening with this phenomenon of the killings, the mass suicide shooters, and I would add, you know, what is not really as easily trackable is the type of operations that are going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, but Iraq in particular, just because you're already in an environment where violence is supposed to be the norm. But when you consider the effect, you know, the record number of suicides, the mental health of the soldiers coming back, as has been documented by veterans groups and even, you know, in some cases, the Department of Defense, you can see that there's a real certain element of psychosis in the military right now. And it's coming from a corrupted faction around what George Shultz and Felix Roatan represent, with Cheney as their poster boy for the policy. But when you look at the games aspect, it's direct. And, you know, you have military institutions teamed up with the entertainment world to actually produce the games that end up on the store shelves. And those are the same games, essentially, that are used in training soldiers.
Well, I want to call the attention of our listeners to the pamphlet, which is a part of this quite stimulating discussion. And anyone who's listening to this who's not somewhat knocked off their feet right now is, as I guess LaRouche would say, blocked. I mean, we're talking about something which seems to exist as an academic phenomenon, the question of cybernetics, the question of social group dynamics, and so on. And yet, these are the people walking into your malls with guns. These are the people walking into churches with guns, into high schools with guns, sitting up in a bedroom, supposedly engaging in some kind of interactive computer game, which turns them out into this kind of threat to society. So I would urge everyone listening to call in and order a box or two of these pamphlets to get out in your neighborhood, to get out in your college campus. You can get this pamphlet, Is the Devil in Your Laptop, from calling LaRouche Pack, and that toll-free number is 800-929-7566. 800-929-7566. And you can also get your friends to listen to the program we had last week on this, as well as this week's, by going on to LaRouchePub.com and scroll over to where it says The LaRouche Show, and you'll find the archive with this program. Now, I want to come back to all of you have brought up extremely interesting and important points, so I want to go back to something, Gabby, in your article, which I think, let me make sure I can find it here, that I found really kind of interesting, this idea of how we became post-human, the question of cybernetics and the social engineering. When you read this, I mean, I've read some of this material, you really have to suspend yourself from reality when you realize that they're talking about human beings. I mean, when you started digging into this, what was your reaction?
It seemed very surreal in the sense that it's very blatant, and it's very much an attack on, and it's an attack to destroy every last bit of humanity in people.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found surprising is that in the past, if you look at one of the necessary components to destroy a society or to induce people to accept the idea that they have no power to change their condition in life, people would have to be convinced that they were animals. Now, these guys are stepping beyond those boundaries, and rather than convincing people that they're animals, they're convincing an entire generation, indoctrinating them to believe that they're cyborgs, that they're on the same level as something inanimate. As a machine, essentially.
Now, this is an interesting question. Let me throw it out to you and then see if O'Young and David have some thoughts on this. When someone walks into a mall and pulls out a gun and starts shooting, How is that what you're talking about? You've actually removed the connection of other human beings, and so they actually are acting as though they're still on a computer? I mean, is that part of what they're doing to people? What do you think, Adam?
I was going to say, yeah, I would agree. I mean, just in terms of watching people who get so immersed into these games, there really is a glaze that you see come over, you know, and that it is part of, I mean, this is why these games were created in the first place, is that on a battlefield, somebody would walk, you know, shooting at paper targets 1 minute and then out onto the battlefield, and even though this may be your so-called enemy, it's a human being, and there would be a flinch on shooting, you know, and these games were created to specifically begin to eliminate that inhibition, you know.
Well, let me read a quote from Lieutenant Colonel David Grossman, one of the experts on video games, that he sent this in response to some comments by Mrs. Helga Zepp-LaRouche, when she called for banning killer video games and internet violence. Grossman, who's retired from the U.S. Army but who's written extensively on this, wrote, The one thing all these killers have in common is that they are all trained on video games. None of them were in martial arts, paintball, or sports. They are death incarnate. That is, they're just murder machines, until faced with a real threat of physical violence. And then their training fails them, and their survival brain says, danger, danger, this is not a game anymore, and then they kill themselves or curl up in a ball and weep. And we saw that in the cases, the various cases of people who, once they could no longer kill, they shot themselves. And any of you have any comments on that?
Yeah, it's something that's an important part of this, the whole story of these, you know, child killers that hasn't really been reported outside of ourselves and Dave Grossman, which is the actual state of mind expressed in these acts, what actually gives you an insight into what their state of mind is in terms of their reaction after the fact or during the act. What is it that snaps them out of it? I mean, you even had a case in Germany where two kids who were planning a massacre were detained by the police, questioned, and then eventually released. And immediately after being released, one of the kids threw himself in front of a bus. So you have to actually wonder what is it that compels, what's this force, what's this unseen force that's impelling people into these acts. It's not as if there's just because there's no rational explanation. It's not just a question of revenge in the typical sense. It's as if there's something outside of their control that's gripped them, that's impelling them into this kind of stuff.
Now, Dave, you've written about one of these social networking groups that's involved in this, and you mentioned before Lewin and others. How conscious are the people who are controlling this, that they actually are creating people whose self-identity is that of cyborgs? And also, Gabby, if you have some thoughts on that after David. But go ahead, David.
Well, in some ways, I guess I would look back to people like John Rawlings Rees at the Tavistock Institute over in London, and his work with Lewin. They both struck out on the battlefield or in the studying shell shock. This was Rees and the Tavistock crew, Eric Tripp and others in that orbit, but they were studying the effect of shell shock on people after the First World War, and then in the Second War they were then sent out into units in so-called command psychiatry, each of them divvied up into different military units. And the idea was to get a sort of on-the-ground view of the psychology of the soldiers and whatnot, you know. So in some ways, the groupings, yes, this is where they began, is to take a look at the mind in a military setting, right? And then, of course, this is where all these games are. So I guess I would say that just as an initial statement.
And Gabby, do you have some thoughts on that?
Well, I think what was brought up earlier, the idea that it's not just some sort of science fiction brought to real life ideology, but that it was a completely necessary component in order for people to have a complete passiveness in terms of their ability to act on the political situation, and also ultimately accept the idea that we're living in a globalized world, and that's inevitably where we're headed. So I think that ideology of the cyborg and the question of the political situation that we're currently in were both necessary hand-in-hand precursors to each other.
And when you go out and organize now, I know you've been in the Midwest recently, do you get a sense of the effects, the desensitizing effects that mass exposure to this kind of culture has on people?
Gabby, I mean, people will recognize it when you point it out how silly it is, but it definitely affects people's emotional attachment to reality.
And
hey, Harley, I would like to,
go ahead.
Harley, I'd like to just throw in one quick thing here.
Sure.
You know, one, in looking at the sort of the ideology of the Tavistock groupings or the related unity of sciences, or the cybernetics groupings, which really are kind of all in the same grouping, but they really did have this view of the mind that was animalistic, that the mind was simply a processor of sensory data, you know, kind of a binary no, yes or no, sort of like how a computer system works out. And if you look at these video games and somebody who's immersed in the middle of them, I mean, you've been reduced to simply a processor of, as quick as you can, assessing the information sent to you on the screen and reacting to it, right? And so in that context, you have people who are completely reduced to their most animalistic sense. And I think that, you know, some of these cases where we've seen where all of a sudden, you know, a teacher calls to the student in the middle of this, you know, shooting spree, and all of a sudden there's some spark of humanity that pulls them out of this purely sensory data moment, where in that moment everyone's just running and they're just shooting just like the video game, and all of a sudden the teacher comes in with like that memory of a human connection, and that snaps them out of it, you know. And at that point, then it becomes game over for them, you know. It's like, oh, wait a second, this isn't, I must have lost somehow because I'm not in the game anymore, you know. And I think that may be where some of this question of the suicide comes in.
Now, Ouyang, how prevalent are game players on campuses? I mean, what do you think would be a fair estimate of how many people are engaged either in MySpace and Facebook, or in the more violent computer video games?
Well, the best way to do a field test on this, judging from my experience in a college dorm, is to go down any typical college dorm hallway. And I remember my experience a few years ago was you'd walk down and there was a strange phenomenon where if people's doors weren't closed and they were doing, you didn't know what they were doing, most people's doors would be open, but you'd go down these silent hallways, and you'd look in each room, and you'd see people's backs, and every single one of them would be turned. They'd be on their computer screen, or on their computers, and invariably, at least when I came in, it was Counter-Strike, because you have these networked games where, you know, there's an added thrill of being able to, like, kill, you know, the guy who's in the next room, or who's on the next floor. And this is just common. You would have this strange kind of social dynamic where you'd have 70 people in one building, or 100 people, or however many. And typically you'd think, wow, this is a real potential for a dynamic kind of social environment for people to discuss and fight over ideas, or, you know, but instead you've got everybody, as soon as they get back from class, or maybe they skip class, like my roommate actually got kicked out of school because he got addicted to video games, wasn't going to class.
I thought he'd be made a professor if he were.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But, you know, so is it prevalent? Yeah, it's prevalent to the extent that you've got, parties being organized by associated student bodies. Like there was recently at Berkeley, a video game, you know, party where people, it's like a nerd fest where people are going to come and, you know, hang out and play Guitar Hero and Halo 3 and, on a Friday night.
We're going to do a public service announcement right now. Parents, if you're listening to this program and you're paying $40,000 a year for your kid to go to Berkeley, they may very well be spending their time playing Counter-Strike, Doom, or World of Warcraft with that money that you're putting in for them. Okay, that's the end of our public service announcement.
Now, the other thing I'd say, just as a autobiographical note, is because this stuff is addictive, and so I had never been a big game player, but my freshman year of college, I got sucked into this Counter-Strike phenomenon. And I know that LaRouche has talked about before. He said that he used to play this game Go, which I guess is this Japanese kind of board game. And the moment that he stopped was when he realized that as he would look at people's faces, in his mind he would rearrange their faces almost unconsciously into the pattern of a Go board. And he said that was it for him. You know, he knew that this wasn't good for his mind. And you know, I distinctly remember the effect of spending hours in this first-person shooter mode. I'd walk down the hallways at school, and I would be almost unconsciously targeting different objects in my path and sort of spinning scenarios in my head, whether it was in class or, you know, somewhere else, about, you know, various, shootouts and things like this. And that's, I could say, I'd be fairly confident I'd probably never end up being a mass killer. But that's a pathological state of mind to be in, to be thinking about headshots as you're walking down, you know, a hallway to class.
Hmm. Well, this is why we've got to get people to become aware of what they're dealing with, what poison this is. And so I'm going to give out the number again for people to call in to get this pamphlet. And that's 800-929-7566. 800-929-7566. Now, merely reading this pamphlet is just the start. I mean, the real question then is, how do you take a population that's being profiled this way and pull them out of it? But I'd like to go back to David, because I know your actual research on this began because you noticed a phenomena of people who were profiling our organizers up in the Seattle area. Why don't you tell us how you got on the track of this INSNA grouping?
Well, it was actually in coordination with the time that we were putting out the Joseph Goebbels on your campus, the pamphlet that led up into the 2006 election. And during that time, we had various attacks that, people throwing water balloons at us. One guy had dumped a bunch of oil and water over two separate tables on the same day. And there began a pattern of articles being written in The Stranger, which we had identified as part of this, so-called independent media, but of course it's the same format in any city you go into, Ruxton Media Group, etc. But in that process then, the level of coordination between the articles, the blogs, and the harassment had a quality to it that just sort of begged a counter-intel, to figure out what was going on. And in this process, one of the blogs that we ran into, which actually was inciting violence in a sort of banal way, but nonetheless inciting violence, was from a UW graduate student, a guy named Tom Dobrowolski. But
University of Washington, for those not from Seattle.
Right, exactly. And this he was out of the School of Information, which is a Tavistock outpost, sort of a transplant from the Research Center on Group Dynamics out of the University of Michigan. But he runs a group called the Urban Archives, which is sort of one of these, I guess you could say, an action anthropology group. And they had, at least on two occasions that I know of, just from being a part of the operations, were running surveillance, you know, taking pictures of us, also at a time when we were, you know, having cops at the scene of the table and telling us to move tables, et cetera. So that kind of played into it. But in checking out Tom Dobrowolski, I ran across this INSNA grouping, and in just sort of the initial profiling, trying to figure out what it was, when I began to look at the professors who, you know, professors that were chairs of sociology, anthropology, psychology departments all across the United States, prominent universities, UCLA, UC Irvine, Stanford, Berkeley, University of Chicago, you know, all, Boston College, all over the country. And so I said, all right, well, this must be a significant grouping. And in the process of trying to put together the profile, realized that these were one of the key groupings involved in creating the social networking technologies. And that they had were essentially a composite of the groupings around the cybernetics crowd, people like Paul Lazarsfeld, who were running these, you know, big profiling operations through data sets around polling and consumer habits and so on to put together kind of these socioeconomic packages for the baby boomer generation to sort of buy into. But
this is a sophisticated form of profiling and then disrupting any group that would interfere with the profiling.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and as I began to dig into it, I always had a nagging question that it sounded a lot like the type of profiling and third force operations that were being run in Africa. And lo and behold, my suspicions were correct in that the other aspect of this grouping was that they were the heirs of the Rose Livingston Institute, which was part of the British Colonial Social Science Research Council of Lord Halley, who had the idea of indirect rule. And, of course, indirect rule, if you think of it, it's, you know, local control, however you want to term it, but the idea of we're going to create a democracy of consensus that will enact the whims of the, you know, at that, of course, in Africa, it was the British and Dutch cartels, the minerals cartels.
So this actually, as we've been talking this hour and the hour last week, what we're looking at is not just mechanisms of social control for purposes of smoothing things out or having harmony in society, but actually by destroying the cognitive powers of the population and homogenizing the thinking and engaging people minimally in disassociative thinking, you're doing what the old imperial strategy has always been, which is producing a population of sheep and cattle that can be easily controlled. Now, the added factor from the groupings that Gabby and Ouyang have identified is that out of this group of human cattle, you find some that can be induced to be killers as a way of inducing a kind of additional terror in the population. Is that a fair summary, Dave?
Definitely. For example, this World of Warcraft, right? There's a kind of added dimension to this, which goes back to kind of what I initially mentioned around this gang counter gang.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the idea that, of course, these social networkers, you know, they study the World of Warcraft. And, you know, we had mentioned earlier the idea of the so-called community managers that keep track over all the people that are playing the various games and whatnot. But one thing that's kind of interesting, I think, is that they did a kind of a little summary of the World of Warcraft where they talked about people who become deeply involved, seemingly have no life. They have a loss of connectivity with the local community, and that's totally immersed in this world of Warcraft. But the last stage is what's called networked individualism, where they just walk away from the games, right? So it kind of makes me beg the question about, are these groupings maybe profiling and running these things with the intention of actually having people walk away into this idea of the networked individualism? I'd kind of like to throw that out as a comment. But just as a quick note, that the groupings this particular grouping kind of traces its origins to a guy named Jacob Moreno, who was the founder of psychodrama, which really is role-playing, and the idea of the sociometry as developing these profiling capabilities. But he, under his journal called Sociometry, you had people such as Frank Stanton, George Gallup.
Yeah,
and George Gallup of Gallup Polls, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is part of a larger operation where they are trying to create this kind of cybernetic society where you have this constant access to the polling, and in that you would be able to enforce this democracy of consensus, because one of their criticisms of Nazi Germany was that it wasn't democratic. But they did agree that you had to have everyone thinking the same way, you know, so
Just have to democratically choose to accept Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the idea of the Gleichschaltung, is that how it is pronounced?
Yeah.
But, you know, that is what the World Wide Web is. We are all on the same page, you know. So anyway, I just wanted to at least throw that in there.
Well, there's going to be a lot more research and a follow-up pamphlet to this. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 22nd, 2007, and we're talking about the new pamphlet that's out, Is the Devil in Your Laptop? And we're talking with three members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who are authors of articles in this pamphlet. Gabby, let me just ask you then, in terms of the effect of this, we're out there organizing on campuses, we're talking to young people. What kinds of questions do you get when someone stops and talks to you about what's in the pamphlet?
Well, there's been obviously a lot of controversy, and on most campuses, I don't know if people are aware, but you have certain clubs. For example, you have a hardcore grouping around anime, and also you have official student clubs that are just around gaming generally.
Really?
And if you walk into any basement or dungeon of entertainment on the universities, you'll find that what people are doing in their leisure time is playing different versions of these games. And the tendency is usually to defend their games if they're not violent. They'll try to defend it, saying, well, I'm playing skateboarding games, that's not going to kill anybody, or I'm playing you know, sports games, whatever it is. But it's very provocative for people when you show them that what is actually happening is their culture as they perceive it is being consciously shaped. So if you can start that as a debate, generally people They'll respond to it, and they'll try to figure
people,
out, okay.
They will talk to you about it. They don't just react and say, hands off my Facebook. Or, you know, you do get people who will talk and discuss this.
Yeah, no, yeah. People are definitely up for the kind of fight, because what we've found is that this has been the unspoken issue for years now on campuses. They'll agree with you on a political issue, but the unspoken issue is the culture that they're immersed in. And if you can bring that to light and really have a debate on it, it gets people more serious.
And Ouyang, would you say this is part of what induces in the youth what we see from the outside is apathy or pessimism, or you might as well not try to change anything because you can't change it?
Yeah, I mean, you get a real visceral sense of that if you just actually look at the quality and the content of the discussion on various blogs, you know, people's personal profiles and things like that. I mean, it's funny, on the game blogs in particular, it's a pretty narrow slice of the overall population, and it's pretty directed. But still, you see that the state of mind is it's manic, and it's manic in the defense of the most banal and stupid aspects of their existence. And and I think it's given us a power in organizing to sort of. There's often been a funny phenomenon with certain people where you're not quite sure. There's no explicit disagreement or agreement. There's just kind of a haze, and you're not sure like what you're really talking to in the person. And often bringing this issue in to just break the ice immediately changes the terms of the discussion. You find out that often it is the case that people are just zonked out. And giving them a little spark of self-consciousness about the effect that it's having, I think, is crucial for the organizing.
Now, just to follow that up, I know, Gabby, you just were involved. I believe you were in Detroit for the town meeting. Were you there?
No, I was in Ottawa.
Oh, that's right. You were in Ottawa. Well, can you give us a quick report on the Ottawa meeting? Because this was a phenomenal event where we actually had a room full of people engaged in the kind of great projects which require people to shut down their MySpace and Facebook and violent video games and actually get up to the task of thinking about how you reconstruct the world economy. So give us a quick report on it.
It was really optimistic. There was about 20 nations represented there, including Lebanon, South Africa, Nigeria, Congo, and there was either representatives from different embassies. In one case, the ambassador from Nigeria was there in person. We also had a couple of engineers and specialists coming in from Mexico who have been discussing some special projects there that have been on the table for numerous years now, specifically the Nahuapa and the Flino water projects. And the whole thing was around the question of what Lynn was laying out directly, having a collaboration between the Western Hemisphere, between Canada, between the United States and Mexico, to show the rest of the world what can be done immediately in the spirit of the Treaty of Westphalia. And when people walked away from that, that was what they had in mind, like the question that's what economics should be. That's what policy discussion should be, the benefit of the other. So it was very good discussion. People were very provoked around thinking
I know Lynn's address took up this question of the benefit of the other. I was hoping you would bring that up, because think about what we've been discussing both last week and this week, and what we're discussing about this absolutely horrendous approach toward man that we see in these social controllers and social engineers, where the other is left out. The other is there to be manipulated, as opposed to this concept on which the nation state is based, which is the benefit of the other. I guess, Gabby, what you're saying is that this is where the optimism comes in, when you realize that we live for some purpose other than to manipulate, shoot up a room, and then go.
Yeah, and you can definitely see that in a lot of these, not just the shooters, but just most of these youth that are resorting to committing suicides, because they don't have any sense of being necessary to society. And that's precisely what we have to give them a sense of.
Right. Now, Ouyang, I know you've been very active in the Bay Area fighting for the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act of Lyndon LaRouche of 2007. Just the last couple of days, we've seen an explosion of news. It's not news to us. In fact, we've been talking about this for a while, that the collapse of the so-called housing crisis is really just an epiphenomena of the overall shutdown of the economy. Now California is talking about a $14 billion deficit for next year, massive budget cuts. Do you think reality is going to start sinking in the minds of some of these people who are telling us to, go away, kid, you bother me?
It better. I mean, we talked to the Speaker of the Assembly on Monday, actually, the day before the figures, the upwardly revised figures were announced for the $14 billion California budget deficit. And in this public forum, that's exactly what we hit on. We said this thing is going to grow. It's happening because of the collapse of the economy, and California's got no options. And we laid out the HBPA and the need for federal intervention. So I've always had the view that in organizing, you have to actually approach it from the standpoint that you have authority because you're acting, and you're not going to derive that based on how people might react to you in the moment. That if you continue to go out, you're persistent, and you know that you're right, there is going to come a time where, at least when people are ready to act, ready to change their thinking, they're going to know where to go. And well, I think we've established that we know that we're the people they have to turn to.
Well, speaking of cyborgs, the person you mentioned, Fabian Nunez, the Speaker of the Assembly, has joined himself at the hip with Arnold the Terminator Schwarzenegger. So
yeah, right.
Now would be a good time for him to get some oil or a saw or whatever he needs to get unattached and to start moving into thinking. But you also, the other point you made, which is important, is you have to be right. You have to have a method of forecasting. And this is what actually distinguishes the capability for advances in human society, the ability to know in advance the effect of a policy, whether it will add to the general welfare and the benefit of the other, or will it undercut that. And, of course, I think what the people we've talked about, the DARPA operations, the individuals, Eric Trist and others that Dave has mentioned, and what the research you've done, Ouyang, what they all have in common is their view that you can't know the effect of a policy, and you just have to go along. So we have a little more than 8 minutes to go, and I'd like each of you just to reflect on this. What kind of changes you expect to see in the weeks and months ahead in terms of what we can do to move this youth population? I mean, Gabby, you're all over the Midwest, and now you're in Boston, you're in Canada. I assume that you have a sense that we're on the verge of a new wave of recruitment to the youth movement, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely see it in the fact that everywhere you go, people have they've reached the point where they can no longer be neutral in what's happening in the world right now. They can't just stand around and simply have no opinion or see themselves on the sidelines. So I think in that sense, we can finally have a real fight over the substance, the question why they aren't acting, and get really subjective with them. What is it that they're not being exposed to in terms of classical culture? What is it, the fact that they're being attacked? Because all of these things that they're engaging in is an attack on their leisure time, mm-hmm. which should be the most creative state of mind that the human being can engage in. So, yeah, this is definitely polarizing everywhere that we're going, because people have to have a say in what's going on. And, you know, it's a lot of controversy, but it's fun.
Well, and what you brought up earlier, the unspoken issue. By making the unspoken issue the subject of self-conscious deliberation, you actually free people from the state of mind that makes them susceptible to this brain-deadening, disassociative culture. Dave, what do you think? What are you looking at?
I would say that in some ways what we're dealing with is the type of craziness, or however you want to term it, that we're heading into, really uncharted waters, that this is not something you can game. And for those people that are thinking that they've got this thing under control, whether it be the economy, whether it be this social engineering projects, that it's in these moments, you know, as Shelley says, where you have the crisis come on, and then people are discussing the profound and impassioned conceptions concerning nature and man. You know, that's where we're coming into. And it's here where you can get these nonlinear effects of people, you know, maybe in the one way where these guys are saying people walk away from the World of Warcraft, hopefully after, you know, groupings aren't on there gaming these things to have just mass violence and whatever, and we're not walking away from them into some sort of tribal existence, but rather that people walk away from them into the great projects of mankind, that as they turn and look for somebody who's been saying something about the insanity of the current situation around the collapse of the economy and so on, you look to LaRouche, and that is, I mean, in terms of optimism and being right on the economy, I mean, in some ways I find it funny because Lynn at one point had said, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, and referring to his own branch of his understanding of the economy, you know. But it's true that people will look for those that are saying something about reality, and that's where this recruitment potential comes in, is that we know what to do.
And Ouyang, as one who has referred several times autobiographically to having come from this culture, I assume that because of your personal experience, and I know you to be a very sober, thoughtful young person, so I not totally shocked to know that you came out of this, but this gives you a confidence, doesn't it, that other people can be reached and jolted and shaken, even if they're going to a place like University of California, Berkeley?
Yeah. I mean, it's what LaRouche said in the Perugia paper, which opens up the pamphlet, that you have a quality of mass demoralization, particularly amongst the youth, which you can trace to the total, you know, failure of leadership at the top, the fact that we've been in a accelerating degenerative slide, especially since Cheney and Bush came in office. And it's got a kind of an existential quality to it. So if you reflect on what we're doing as a mass movement to change that, to reverse that demoralization by introducing the question of political leadership, if you really reflect on what we've done, say just around this Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, it's pretty amazing. I mean, we're a relatively tiny group of active full-time members who have, in the course of a couple of months, created out of what didn't exist before. There wasn't even there wasn't even in germ form. We simply created a mass-based, or at least the foundations of a mass-based movement amongst the county, state, local leadership around this legislative initiative. And LaRouche's standard is that you're constantly intervening. So when you're kind of working through that on a day-by-day basis, you can forget how incredible it is that, you know, we've unleashed something that would not have existed. There's no way that you would have city councils and state legislatures right now calling for federal intervention on this specific point of freezing foreclosures and creating the conditions for a bankruptcy reorganization. That just wouldn't exist if we hadn't organized for it. And it's actually accelerated. It's accelerating now. We're going to city councils, as Rihanna brought up in the last program. The effect of that just on some of our contacts, to see that we actually go in public and we're not a debating society, we actually fight with these ideas in public, testifying at these city councils. That has a huge effect on people who, in general, spend most of their time, you know, in various forms of diversion from reality.
And Gabby, we have just a little over a minute to go. You're preparing to sing a concert tomorrow. Why don't you give us a very quick report on what you're doing?
We're reviving the classical notion of salons, basically where you get a group of people together, and we're inviting our contacts from the New England Conservatory, people that have various training in either music or science, or just want to see what a real classical culture in the making is like. So we've been training rigorously. We've been having 4-hour rehearsals every day, and we've been working through some of the ideas in the motet, Bach's Jesu meine Freude. So the idea is to have not a definitive performance tomorrow, but a higher hypothesis of bringing out the ironies in that piece.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to hearing it, and hopefully those of you listening will find out how to pick that up from the website. Gabby, David, and Ouyang, thanks for joining us this afternoon on The LaRouche Show. Again, you can get this pamphlet by calling 800-929-7566, 800-929-7566. Go on the LaRouche Pack website, and we'll be with you next week on The LaRouche Show every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Thanks for joining us today.